The Variety Artist, episode 25. This one's all about raising the bar. Episode 25. It's been 25 weeks since I started this whole venture. A milestone in my book. And do I have the perfect guest for you? A true variety artist. His journey and philosophies reflect a lot of things we're trying to do here on the Variety Artist Podcast. Welcome to week 25. I hope you're enjoying listening as much as I'm enjoying doing them. Here we go. Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. They're offering you, the Variety Artist, a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at thevarietyartist.com/book. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Just go to thevarietyartist.com/book right after this podcast and get your free audiobook. Now, let's start the show.
Welcome to The Variety Artist, providing aspiring artists and entertainers with in-depth discussions from top performers from all over the world. So get ready to book some gigs, make some money, and have some fun with your host, John Abrams.
He's a comedian, he's a contortionist, he's a fire eater, he's an MC, he's a pancake juggler, he's a live entertainment expert. But he's most known for running one of the best, maybe the best, live weekly variety shows in the country with Scott Neary's Booby Trap. Variety artist, I give you Scott Neary.
Yes, he's given you me to you.
Here you are.
I'm a gift.
What's going on, Scott?
Hey. Well, I'm just sitting in my beautiful Hollywood apartment, living life. I just had some tuna salad. It's a good day.
It is a good day. I was researching last night some of your reel tapes and all different Scott Neary. I went down the Scott Neary rabbit hole.
Oh, geez.
And the first one I see, the first 10 seconds I'm online, I see you interviewing Demetrius Johnson, one of my heroes. Yeah. What was that? What was going on there?
Well, there's this festival in Las Vegas, a music festival mostly called Life is Beautiful. And they had learning stages, which were basically TED Talk stages. And Demetrius didn't have, and a few other people, they didn't have TED Talks of their own. I was hosting the stage, introducing the people, but he didn't have his own TED Talk. So he just came out and had a conversation with me, and then we did some Q&A with the audience. He was an amazing, eloquent talker, a really like warm spirit. And if you guys don't know him, he's a small guy who is an incredible mixed martial art fighter.
He's known and he is one of the best fighters ever.
Yeah.
He had 10 successful championship defenses and he fights at 125. So you're right. He's a small guy.
I was expecting him to be kind of macho or I don't know. I think part of what his strength was in meeting him to me, I think part of his strength is the same as with most masters. He's very open. He's very open to the world. Kind of stays in a creative space of being, having eyes wide open, experiencing things in a very creative and generous way.
And who else was on that list?
There was a woman she was declared the ugliest woman in the world. She has a degenerative disease that she has trouble, like her body doesn't absorb nutrients or something. So she's very skinny. And if you look up ugliest woman in the world, you'll see her. But she had she had a great sense of humor and a wonderful positive attitude. And she's beautiful. She's like so wonderful as a person that we got to like, everybody in the room was just wowed by her. She didn't rebel against the ugliest woman thing. She didn't try to have some amazing inner beauty to make up for it or anything like that. She just like really was vulnerable with everybody and told people how much it hurt to be declared that, but also what she was doing with that position and that notoriety.
So who declares that?
Mean people on the internet, I guess.
I guess so, huh? Well, as I was going down your rabbit hole, I noticed not only did you do you've done tons of different interviews, but you were in Scary Movie 5.
Yes.
What was that experience like?
That was crazy. I got this call. They're looking for a skinny contortionist. So I sent an email, said I could do it. And then the movie they were parodying was Mama, which was a crazy horror movie thing with a with this witch ghost woman.
I remember that.
Went out and checked out that movie, and then I looked at screen tests, and I sent in a video audition of me contorting in different mangled, crazy ways, just like the character in the movie. And then I, the next day at noon, they were like, "Yep, good, you've got it."
Oh,
I worked for several weeks on that. It was a really fun job, and I also, since I was on set, they used me as Snoop Dogg's stunt double.
Oh. And did they hook you up? I noticed you're flying in that.
Yeah. So I'm on, I do wires. I'd never done that stuff before. I did like a fall, like a 10-foot fall. And I did a 15-foot fall on a wire. They hang me up, pull me up on a wire. And then I fall 15 feet into a hot tub. Uh-huh. I'm in this really like big mask that's covering my face. And then I have these latex full arm gloves that extend my fingers and make me look all bony and weird. I fell into the hot tub, which wasn't heated. It was just a tub, which was actually pretty cold. I fell in and I had to thrash around for as long as I could and then come up. And when I came up for air, the mask was completely full of water and I couldn't pull the mask away from my face. So I just had to wait for it to drain, even though I was completely out of breath and I just did a fall and thrashing. And I almost drowned, and then I almost got hypothermia from like water.
So the thrashing was real.
Yes, the thrashing was real. I was fighting for my life.
Like, get me out of this mask. Ah! It's a crazy clip.
Yeah.
Yeah. You also did the Tonight Show.
Yeah.
How'd you get on that?
I had a friend that connected me with that. He had seen some video of stuff that I'd done with unusual object manipulation, and he worked for the show. They were looking for some different tricks, and he asked me if I could still do this one trick, and I didn't know if I could, but I was like, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
When is it? Two weeks? Yeah. Okay. No problem.
Piece of cake.
Yeah.
What was the trick? Do you remember?
It was flipping a styrofoam cup in my mouth. So I had to hold the cup in my mouth, spit, like blow and spit it up in the air, and it flips around and I catch it back in my mouth. Uh-huh. I was very nervous. If I was doing an act that I normally do, I wouldn't have been so nervous, but I was really nervous. I went on the show and they did a little interview. They talked to me a little bit and then I did the trick, but I thought I had to just hit the trick perfectly the first time. And as soon as I missed the first time, the cup hit my mouth and I heard it echo. And I knew that my microphone was still on. And I was like, oh my God, thank you. Then I told jokes about missing. And I missed a few more times and got in a few more jokes. And it really worked well. And then I hit the trick and it killed. And it was like, it was an amazing experience.
Did they keep the whole thing with the jokes and everything? Or did they just?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
So you had a whole spot.
I had a whole spot. And it was so fun to do that. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, let's go back a little bit. Let's go back to the Brooks and Dunn Neon Circus.
Brooks and Dunn did a Neon Circus and Wild West show tour. They basically wanted to do Cirque du Soleil for rednecks.
Oh.
That's what they said. Or for hillbillies.
Okay.
So this tour turned into the highest grossing country music tour ever.
About what year is this?
It started in 2001.
Okay.
And ran after that every summer. They were looking for circus people, and I was kind of fresh off doing street shows.
And what were you doing specifically?
I did juggling. When I came on at night, I juggled fire. So I came out with two lit torches. I did a handspring with the torches in my hands, and then somebody threw me another torch, and I passed juggling with another guy.
Huh.
There was a guy with a lasso on fire. There was another guy fire breathing.
Oh my gosh.
It was great.
Sounds like fun.
Yeah.
Now you created something called Culinary Tuesdays. It was a cooking show.
Yes.
So wait, before I even get into that, I've already mentioned Demetrius Johnson. I've already mentioned The Tonight Show, Scary Movie 5. You've talked about street performing and some sort of tour with Brooks and Dunn. And we're only 10 minutes in.
Okay.
And now we're going to talk about a cooking show that you created. What was that all about?
Most of the rest of the podcast will be silent because this is my whole career.
That's it. We're done.
The cooking show was, I did this one-man show in San Francisco. I was doing this pancake flipping act and this theater owner said, hey, if you want to, you did a great job promoting this one-man show. If you want to promote our theater shows, you can do your cooking show on Tuesdays for free.
Oh.
I was like, cooking show? Yeah, sure. I didn't really have a cooking show, but I just made one up in a few weeks and started doing it every week. And I did it for 6 weeks. And then I went and did a gig, big gig in Japan. And I came back with money and I funded doing another 6 week run or another 6 month run in the same theater on the weekends.
I have to read this from the LA Times talking about your pancake juggling, because This is one of the coolest things I've ever read in my life. Here it is. Neri never splatters while mixing patter with the batter. And there's nothing like a hot skillet to add sizzle to a juggling routine. LA Times.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
How'd you come up with that pancake thing?
I was doing pretty much a stolen juggling act. I was doing Frank Olivier's, a lot of tricks and jokes from Frank Olivier. That's how I started out. Because I started doing my own thing and then it didn't work at all and I was scared and I was on the street trying to perform street shows. So I just like fell back on the thing I knew that worked and I started doing Frank Olivier's act. And after a few months, he came and saw me out on the street.
Uh-oh.
And he was like, hi, I think it's time for you to get your own stuff.
You think?
I was also incorporating like some weird tricks in my show. So I started incorporating more weird tricks in my show and just seeing what those were. Like I threw a bucket two stories high and caught it on my head.
Yep.
And it hurt and everybody laughed. And I did tricks with duct tape and I found a karate vest in the garbage and then I'd have people punch me in the chest.
Ow.
And then I started thinking if people really stuck around, then maybe they would really enjoy what I'm doing.
Uh-huh.
So I had this old idea with a friend of cooking a pancake and flipping it, doing different flipping tricks. So I put together this act, brought it out on the street, and it worked great. People wanted to see what would happen at the end with the pancake when it was done cooking.
Now, at some point in time, I was reading that you were doing all sorts of variety entertainment and the pancake juggling. And at one point in time, you kind of gave it all up.
Yeah. In 2007, I had this idea for a propaganda show.
Mm-hmm.
This guy named Fred Anderson in San Francisco offered to produce my show in Edinburgh Fringe Festival. And I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, but I thought maybe a show about propaganda. I really was fascinated with propaganda. So I thought maybe a show about propaganda would be good at the Edinburgh Fringe. I started working on it and I studied propaganda and I studied marketing and I lied my way into a marketing job.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was just kind of getting disillusioned with performing in general. And I was doing all these shows in LA where I was really one of the best. Usually I was the best act in the show.
Yeah.
And for me, that's a bummer. I don't like that. I like to be able to grow because I kind of identified myself as an underdog for a really long time. When I was doing these shows and I wasn't really motivated, I didn't see where I was going to grow. I didn't see what direction I needed to grow. I didn't see like any motivation to really push me to move forward in performing. I thought maybe I'll get into graphic design or some kind of marketing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And as I had this job already, I just kind of dug into it and started learning all this stuff about marketing. I got a call from the World Busker Festival in Christchurch, New Zealand. And the lady called me and said, would you like to come do this festival? And it's a prestigious, huge festival, especially then. It was bigger than ever at that time. I said, I don't know. What do I have to do?
And you're not performing at that time, right?
I wasn't. Yeah, I was kind of performing sometimes, but I wasn't super driven to just do everything like I normally was.
Yeah.
I was lackluster about it. She said she wasn't used to getting that response, I think.
Yeah.
And she was like, well, we send you a contract and you sign it and then we send you plane tickets. And I was like, okay. So she sent me the contract, signed it, went off to New Zealand, took a week and a half off of work, went to New Zealand. It was incredible. It was the best performing experience I'd ever had in my life. I met amazing world-class entertainers. I was so inspired and everything mattered. And then the audiences were incredible, super supportive of the arts and street performing, which doesn't really happen in America. I don't know. It was just incredible. I met a bee farmer. It was great. I quit my job basically before I got back on the plane to come home.
Nice.
And I've been at it ever since.
And you recharge your battery, huh?
Yeah. Just gave me a reason. And so now with Scott Neri's Booby Trap, it's kind of that. It's like I get to bring together really amazing acts that all can motivate each other. All like people get really excited. Stand-ups get really excited to meet a magician or an acrobat. Jugglers get excited to meet a comedy musician or a stand-up or whatever. So like all these people kind of feed off of each other. Every week we get to do this show with 15 acts that has a great audience, has great performers, and we all get to just live our bliss for an hour and a half every week.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk more about Booby Trap. For people who haven't seen it that aren't in LA, what is Booby Trap? Kind of explain what it is.
Booby Trap is a circus variety show. It's basically 12 to 15 acts in a night. Each act has 4 minutes of the show. The acts range from ventriloquist to contortionist to juggler to comedian to musician to then we have acrobats that hang from the ceiling like Cirque du Soleil. Former Cirque du Soleil performers come and do the show. And then occasionally we have celebrities in the audience or on stage. We've had Steve-O, Tom Arnold, Reggie Watts, all on the show. And the show is basically, it started out as an open mic night where I wanted to bring together a bunch of performers and do a show. And then after a few weeks, we had too many performers to do the show was 27 acts long. We just couldn't get through. So I had to start booking it. And then after that, we just kept on improving it. And I was like calling every performer on the phone. And then I was calling all the audience members on the phone and promoting it that way. So I was, from the beginning, I was curating every part of it and trying to make every part of it great. I think that's a thing that really stands out from other shows is that shows often promote through Groupon and discount sites a lot, and then they end up with people that want discounts in the audience instead of people that are ready to be an audience.
Well, now that you've had, I don't know, 4 years worth, right?
We're going on four, yeah.
Going on four. Now that it's already established, and are you still sitting on the phone calling people?
I still spend time on the phone, but not as much. I have more of a system for organizing all the acts. We have an email newsletter for the audience and social media and stuff like that. We are still very community-based. Not so much just generally feeding a community, but trying to create a community that feeds individuals. I'm not much of a person that like says, we need to help variety artists in general. I feel like we need to help keep nurturing great entertainment and not sucky entertainment.
Yeah.
We don't need to support people that suck. We need to like support people that are awesome. And I think that nurturing great entertainers gives subpar entertainers or beginner entertainers a reason to strive for better.
Yeah. It helps them up their game.
Exactly. Yeah.
How does an act get in to Booby Trap?
A lot of them are people that I've known from performing since I was 11 years old.
Oh,
I've performed all over the world and I met tons of amazing entertainers, but I also get video submissions and those go through the Booby Trap, our group of people that help to look at submissions, and then we figure out what acts fit well thing, not just by quality of entertainment, but also by aesthetic and things that tend to work for our audience.
Mm-hmm.
I've wanted for a long time to be able to show people what's good. I think that that's an important thing because a lot of people have a bad impression of magicians or jugglers. Yeah. Like they don't want to see a juggler, definitely, but they come to the show and they see a bunch of things they didn't want to see, and then they walk away super pumped that they saw it. Then they get to understand that it isn't that you don't get juggling or that you don't like a balloon twister. It's that they didn't actually reach out to you and entertain you.
Right.
I think that gives people more agency to find things that they like, get pumped, and follow these performers that are really fighting for to move people and to open people up.
Yeah. I mean, I have a theory about that. A lot of folks, they don't want to see a magician or a juggler because they've seen bad magicians and bad jugglers.
Yeah.
You know, and bad variety artists. Person will go into an audience thinking I'm going to see that same bad juggler, bad magician, bad variety artist. And when they're blown away, it's a whole new experience for them.
Yeah, totally. I love that.
So what are some of the struggles putting together? I know this weekly podcast, it's hard work, and I'm only getting one guest per week. You're getting 15, is that right?
Yeah.
So what are some of the struggles of putting that together?
Well, I don't have to schedule them because the show's always at the same time, so that helps. I built an app to manage all the performers and the bookings. So as soon as I go to the date on the app and I enter their name, then it sends them an email and sets them all up, puts them in the lineup, and they're ready to go. So that helps out a lot. It saves me a lot of communication stuff. Part of the struggle is we're constantly raising the bar of what the quality of the show is.
Yeah.
So we're always looking for new things that are badass and trying to figure out how to put people in the right place so that they can all kill and that they can all have a good time. Because you asked me if I had a horror story earlier.
And sure.
One example of a story that a show that didn't go well for me was I was paid a lot of money to perform in this fancy hotel for 500 people. And I had a wireless microphone. I came in and they had a DJ to run the sound. They didn't really have good stage lighting. And it was a banquet hall with 500 people sitting spread out at tables. I came in, tested the sound with the DJ. And then when the room was full, I came up, got introduced. My mic fed back. I couldn't get it to stop feeding back. So I turned it off. I tried to use the DJ's handheld mic and it fed back and didn't work. I could either just punish people with terrible screeching, or I could try to just shout. So I just shouted across this huge room that was maybe like a third of the size of a football field. I just shouted across this room trying to do my whole show with understated jokes and everything. And I just didn't feel, I felt like they could have hired a stilt walker for $100 that has a crazy hat on, and that would have been better for the audience who just kind of wanted to hang out with each other anyway, and they're eating food. It was so
that's awful.
I do these kind of gigs a lot where people don't understand how to use an entertainer to their max, and I could be replaced by somebody who's cheaper and doesn't go through all the work that I go through. So when I come back to LA and I get to do Booby Trap, that is an awesome opportunity to actually do the thing that I dream of doing, that I dreamt of doing, the reason I got into this. And I think that that's the thing that's lacking for a lot of entertainers, is to get in front of a really great audience without a long tech rehearsal, without a lot of complicated hotels and rental cars and all the stuff that goes into doing these shows, and just get in there and do the thing that they've worked all their life at, and have it pay off and show and see their own value. And I forget what the question originally was, but yeah,
it doesn't matter.
that's why people do it, I think, is because it actually gives them that chance to do that.
Well, it's one of the things I've always, while doing all this research, I really admire about what you've been doing. Every single step of the way, it seems like you've been trying to up your game.
Yeah.
You know, trying to become a better performer, trying to raise the bar of all variety artists. And that includes, and especially is with Booby Trap.
Yeah. Thank you.
You've done, 4 years times once a week, like 200 Booby Trap shows or so.
Yeah. 172.
Is that what it is? 172?
Yeah.
So you have any crazy audience stories? things that happened maybe with the audience?
We had a guy early on. So the show is pretty crazy and chaotic, and I bring a lot of energy to it. Mm-hmm. It's act after act. So if I don't bring energy, then it can get very monotonous if I just introduced one act after the other.
Yeah.
And I'm constantly modifying that energy. So if I have like a slow act and then a big flashy act is about to come on, I'm going to need to bring the energy up or else it's going to be really awkward. Or if I have a contortionist that kills and then a stand-up is about to come on who might start small, then I need to bring the energy down, chill everybody out, and get everybody ready to listen. And I love doing that really fast. I bring a lot of energy and there's a lot of chaos because I feel like people need to feel a little bit uncomfortable in order to really be entertained, in order to be changed by a show. So one thing that we do is we throw snacks out to the audience. We throw them really hard and it's funny and people get hit in the face and stuff like that. So this one couple was sitting there with their arms crossed after we did that. I was like, what's going on with these people? Why are these people doing that? And then the lady got hit in the face with a snack and she was really pissed. Oh, before I found out that information, I went on stage and I said, hey, you guys, you two are choosing to sit there with your arms crossed, looking all grumpy. Well, this is a choice that you have. You could choose tonight to have the best night of your life, but you are choosing to do this instead. I just want you to know that that's your choice, and this is completely within your control. So if you want to have a bad night, that's up to you. But these performers are here, and they're killing it, and they are giving you the opportunity to open up and have some fun. It's up to you.
Yep.
The next time I came out, I found out that she'd gotten hit in the face. And then, so I was like, we had a bottle of Prosecco, kind of a cheap bubbly wine in the fridge. So I pulled it out and I said, hey, I heard somebody got hit in the face with some chips. And the guy raised his hand and I went over to him and I was like, here you go. Here's your bottle of champagne. You won. You got hit in the face with chips. Congratulations. And he's like, I don't want your champagne. And I was like, oh, okay. Well, what can I do for you? He was like, I got hit in the face. And I was like, okay, yeah. What can I do? How can we fix it for you? It was part of the whole audience, you know, it was crazy. So then
it's really uncomfortable. Huh?
It was pretty tense. He said, maybe an apology. And so I was like, yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to hurt you. This was all done in order to have fun and to make this a fun show for everybody. And my friend, who was also throwing snacks at the time, he came out and he apologized also, like just public apology, really straightforward. And then the next time I came out, they were still sitting there grumpy.
Of course.
And I was like, you guys, just leave. Just leave. And they were like, the guy was like, no, we're here to see my friend, then we'll leave. I was like, who's your friend? And he said, Josh. And I was like, well, lucky for you, Josh is the next act.
Yeah.
So I brought Josh on, even though he was supposed to be the last act. Josh was so embarrassed after the show because he was visiting town. He'd lived in LA earlier, but he had brought these two people with him and he was so embarrassed that he brought them because the guy was being such a grump.
So did they leave?
So after Josh, then I was like, get out of here. Right on stage. I just like yelled, get out of here. And everybody in the audience is like, get out.
Yay. And then
they went around the corner and they were complaining and they had come on. They like picked up their motorcycle helmets and walked out. And they went around the corner and they were complaining to the ticket lady and like, we need to get our money back. And this was terrible. This isn't even entertainment. This isn't funny. And I was like, all these people seem to disagree.
Yep.
And then I said, you two were the only two in the audience with helmets. You should have worn them. And the audience went crazy. And the people left.
Oh, that's great. I learned my lesson.
Yeah.
I do school assemblies and occasionally you'll see that teacher on her cell phone. I was doing a show years ago, and sure enough, there's a teacher on her cell phone. All the kids are laughing. Everybody's having a good time. Teachers are having a fun time. Everybody's laughing, having a great time. And she's on her phone with an angry look on her face. And my standard line is, oh, you're texting all your friends, and what a great show this is.
Yeah.
And so she looks up and gives me a dirty look, same type of thing as your friends there. So I finish up the show and I'm all done with the show. And then she comes up to me after the show. She says, well, I didn't appreciate what you said during the show. Yeah. And I said, well, you know, everybody else is having a great time and you were on your phone. So, you know, the kids see that and they emulate their teachers. And so they're going to probably do the same thing. And she says, oh no, I was on the phone with my doctor and I'm having some real bad health problems. So I was texting my doctor and I felt so bad. Because here I called her out. And I mean, I felt like saying, well, you know, if you're going to text your doctor, get the heck out of the room and text your doctor there so the kids don't see you. But of course, I was real nice.
Don't worry about it because she's still suffering from lying to you.
Oh, there you go.
That's a lie. That's definitely.
Oh, you think that's a lie? It might have been.
Yeah.
Do you have any crazy performer stories? There's got to be a bunch.
No. Nobody's been.
No.
Everybody's pretty good.
I don't mean people that weren't good.
No, not everybody's been good either. I don't know. It's been such a blast, and the entertainers have just been incredible. We had a monk that came and sang one time.
Oh.
And that was just amazingly powerful. He did it without a microphone and just filled up the room. I don't even know what he's a monk of. I usually know what a favorite act is or something. I'll think of it later maybe. But Seth Ward is a crazy performer who dresses like a snake and swallows an audience member, or he dresses like a caterpillar and emerges from a cocoon as a, which his caterpillar costume is just a child's sleeping bag with arms glued onto it. And he emerges from a cocoon as this terrible mutant black butterfly moth thing that's destroyed, and he just yells a lot and he's crazy and he's in the audience's face. You can see him on The Gong Show a lot or on America's Got Talent, but he his live stuff is just, it's so intense and it's so in people's faces,
completely outrageous. Now, they have 4 minutes, is that right?
Yeah, every act has 4 minutes.
And what if they go over?
If they go over, then there's all kinds of chaos. There are these like dancing men, like at a car dealership, those air dancers, those things go off. We have a sponsor, Look Our Way, who creates those air dancers. So they sent us like 6 of them. There are all these dazzling disco lights and the band plays and it just goes crazy and it's really fun. It started out with a bass drum that we would hit if they went over time, but now it's like this not so berserk thing and I come on stage dancing and I yell at them to leave. And
does the audience love that?
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that one part is like people are used to seeing variety in a critical realm. They see reality talent competitions like American Idol, America's Got Talent, Gong Show. That's how we usually see variety. We don't have a real celebration of variety acts in mass media anymore. So having a 4-minute limit gives people a safe zone. They know no matter what's happening, I can deal with it for 4 minutes.
Sure.
Them knowing that I'm going to come on with an iron fist and I'm going to make sure that it's adhered to, that's a real relief for people. Then they don't have to be critical anymore. They can just enjoy whatever it is. If the act just makes them feel uncomfortable, builds a lot of tension in the room and nothing happens, then I come on and say, wow, there's a lot of tension in the room. You guys really didn't like that. And then they laugh and we celebrate that weird moment that we all had caused by that act.
That's cool.
The idea is like, yeah, I love life and I want people to be able to celebrate moment, like every moment. Some of my best trips and adventures were taken with my one friend who every time we're together, things go wrong. Everything just goes wrong and it's horrible and the food is disgusting and whatever. And we have so much fun laughing at how terrible things are. I think that anything can be put in a context where you enjoy it. And I think that's a message that people from the audience, hopefully, and performers take with them into their lives so that when whatever happens, then they can they can go, oh, this is crazy. I love it.
Even in those uncomfortable minutes.
Yeah, exactly. Especially in those uncomfortable minutes. When you're comfortable, everything's going as planned, and that's the most boring. That's not life.
Right.
The challenge is, how do I experience this fully? What are the downsides of it? How do I feel? Like, do I feel angry or sad or whatever? That's great. I love feeling things. That's being alive. And being uncomfortable is like when I was a kid and starting to do magic shows when I was 11, I didn't even want to wear like a strong deodorant because I didn't want to taint the experience. I wanted to have like the most pure experience without any distractions from the magic.
Oh.
I wanted to perfectly script it and perfectly perform it. As I started growing up and seeing more and like actually realizing the acts that I liked, they were all super flawed. They were like Amazing Jonathan and even David Copperfield. He has so much flaw and so much charm and awkwardness and all that stuff. So I started realizing that that uncomfortability is actually what makes great moments.
So when you're watching all the acts go up in your booby trap, mm-hmm. is it just got to be fun just to see what the heck is going to happen with the audience, with the performer?
Yeah. And my taste is basically about what kills with the audience. So sometimes people have trouble with that. They ask me for compliments about their act and I tell them how the audience reacted. And they're like, yeah, what do you think of this joke? And I was like, yeah, it worked great.
It's not my act. I don't know.
Yeah. And I don't,
it's not my job.
And I don't care about a joke. Like some things are kind of funny to me. Like some jokes are funny to me, but it's rare and I don't care. Like even Reggie Watts, the first time I saw him perform, I loved him.
Yeah.
But not because if I was watching him do that thing on tape, I wouldn't care. Or if he was doing it for just me in a room, it would be pretty weird. And I might like it a little bit. I don't know. But what he did with an audience was insane. And he was tapped perfectly into the rhythm of the audience. And he responded, even though it didn't seem like he was listening, he was responding perfectly to the energy of the room, pacing out everything so perfectly to make it work. And that's what blew me away. I wasn't like, oh, I love him doing music or whatever. I was like, wow, this audience is insanely on fire right now.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I watch entertainment in general, live entertainment. That's also a thing that's important to me, is that somebody isn't just performing, somebody isn't just putting something on stage, but they're actually entertaining live. They're connecting with what the audience is doing and adjusting and creating something for those people that are there. And I'll change the order around because I'm like, oh, this act that I thought was this, I don't know, juggling act that I thought was going to be super high energy and get the audience pumped up, it didn't really work. So now I can't bring on a stand-up because they don't really trust the show.
Right.
Audience needs to be turned over. So I'm going to move this magician down and put him there, and then he'll pick up the audience and we are in a good place again, so everybody can start killing again.
Let's switch gears a little bit of maybe some advice for a beginner, somebody just starting out.
Yeah.
Like you were so many years ago.
Yeah. The thing that most people told me was to get on stage a lot. And I think that's pretty much the thing. Get on stage a lot. I've heard like magicians and variety of performers tell me that there aren't any open mics for magic or juggling, but that doesn't matter. Just go to open mics that are for comedy or music. Ask them if you can go on. People have a hard time saying no. They probably will like it and celebrate it, and it'll be a cool part of, it'll mix up their night and they'll like it. Otherwise, you can go to music shows that you see happening, go up to the band ahead of time and say, hey, could I just do 5 minutes? I do magic and I just want to go on for 5 minutes. It's really funny stuff. I'll do some magic tricks for the crowd and warm them up. And it's a totally different thing. A lot of times bands will like that because it isn't conflicting with what they do.
Mm.
Like a musician opening for them, they'll have to figure out if they're good enough. But with a magician, they don't really care because it's just a silly, weird thing to put on before them.
And it's way different than what they do.
Yeah, yeah.
How about for the working pro? You have some advice for somebody who's been doing it for a while?
The biggest challenge for me, like I said, it was when I felt like I was at a top level and I didn't feel like I had anywhere to grow. It's an important thing for entertainers to remind themselves why they started, what they really experienced, and kind of figure that out. It might take some examination to figure out what you experienced the first time you got into entertainment. It's really easy to lose track by talking to other performers when you get into like the magic community or the entertainment community or whatever. It's really easy to lose track of what you thought was happening on stage and what's important to you. Because all of a sudden you're trying to impress other performers around you, or you're trying to level up in these ways that never were part of your core interest. So right. Reminding yourself what that core interest is and shooting for it. Like for me, I loved opening people up. I loved giving people kind of a feeling of hope. That's what I liked about magic, was if you saw something that you didn't think was possible, or that you just felt like you were wrong, then maybe you were wrong about all the things that disappoint you in life. I loved that. So I saw the same thing in athleticism and juggling and stuff like that, and in comedy. So that's what I try to bring to every audience. And by being refreshed in that idea, I am motivated and pumped to go out on stage and do better than I've ever done before.
Great advice. Great stuff. You got me thinking.
Good. What was your core? What do you think? When did you start?
When did I start doing this?
Yeah.
I was kind of a late bloomer. A lot of magicians talk about how they got their first magic set when they were like 10 years old or 9 years old. I was an actor for years.
Okay.
At 29 years old, I met a magician that showed me an amazing magic trick. And I was so inspired, I ended up working for him for 5 years and doing the dancing girls and live tigers and traveling around the U.S. Yeah. All that kind of thing.
Wow.
And then at 34 years old, I decided to do it myself.
Nice. When you started acting, what did you, was there a movie or an actor or a play that you saw that said, I need to do this?
Actually, I did a lot of live theater in high school. I did a lot of school plays and scenes and such. And I did one scene one time. I remember the assignment. The assignment, we were studying commedia dell'arte, where you put a mask on and do some sort of entertainment with a mask. I remember putting on a paper bag over my head. Do you remember the old Gong Show from the 80s or 90s? There was a guy named the Unknown Comic who used to put a bag over his head and do comedy. And so myself and a friend of mine, we put bags over our heads, and we did an entire scene with bags over our heads celebrating commedia dell'arte. And it was that scene that made me think, oh gosh, I can do this for a living. But I didn't realize at the time that to make a living acting is really, really hard.
Right.
You can make a ton of money at once and then you don't work for another year or so, or at least I didn't.
Right. What was, besides making money, what was the spark that you felt, or what did you feel that you're giving or creating in that moment when that happened?
I loved the both the feeling, it's kind of selfish, but the feeling I got from the applause and the excitement, and also the feeling the audience got.
Yeah.
You know, it was a kind of a give and take thing. I just loved that and have loved that ever since.
Yeah.
You know, and that's one of the reasons that I do school assemblies, and because every single show, it's a full house. I'm doing it in front of 300 people that appreciate what I'm doing. I'm teaching them great life skills. And in the meantime, getting great applause and screaming and yelling and having a bunch of fun. Awesome. I have fun for a living.
Yeah. That's amazing.
See, now you're interviewing me.
Yeah. Well, I'm interested. I think people listening it will be interested too.
Yeah. In fact, I have another podcast coming out. Somebody interviewed me that I talk about all this. I think I was telling this interviewer that I kind of go back into my childhood. And when I was 8 or 9 years old, my parents got divorced. So I think I was looking for attention since then.
Yeah. I think attention is a shallow explanation for things. People say like looking for attention or whatever, but we don't want all attention. We don't want like people to criticize us. I think there's a deeper stuff. A lot of times, like, people will become a doctor because they want to, they might be a cancer doctor because they're their mom had cancer, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it's the same kind of thing. We're trying to serve a purpose and feel useful in doing something that we need, our inner self needs. I always got like bummed out when people said that when a performer says that they're doing it just for the attention, because I've always, in longer conversations with them, I've found something deeper that's a real need that they have that's way more generous and way more optimistic. And you say that it's selfish to feel the applause, but the applause is just a symptom of you having a communally good time. And I think that's a beautiful thing.
Thank you.
That's like an important thing for me, because people experience variety artists as being very surface, like having some costume that doesn't mean anything to them, that's just brightly colored because they think that that's what they need to wear, cheaply doing something that they learned in a book and not really bringing their soul to it. The great entertainers that I know, I want people to see them for who they are and see that passion. And I want to bring that out, because each of them has a purpose and each of them has a story. And to me, that's what the power of these variety artists is. The juggling or the yo-yo tricks or the hula hooping, these are excuses for us to watch and connect with a new human being and form a new relationship with them and with a group of strangers around us. Mm. That is like so needed as humans. As long as people keep seeing variety artists as these like people that are so guarded by their clowniness or whatever, that's a reinforcement of their own guardedness and their own lack of vulnerability. And that's no good for anybody.
The thing that draws people in the most when you're entertaining is your honesty and your heart.
Yeah.
If they're actually seeing you for what you are, you're absolutely right about the mask.
Yeah.
When you drop the mask and show who you really are. I was watching yesterday I was watching the Gary Shandling, the Zen Diaries of Gary Shandling. Have you seen that?
I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, it's wonderful. But he talks about this constant struggle to show himself on stage, to be himself on stage.
Yeah.
And the more himself he is, the more people accept what he's doing and love what he's doing, and the more successful he becomes.
Yeah. Huh. I think that stuff, saying that he's trying to be as much himself on stage as possible. I mean, you are always yourself, no matter how scared and guarded you are, you're always yourself. But that comes to the thing that I said about getting on stage as much as possible. It's completely unnatural situation to be on stage in front of people with, and the conversation doesn't flow very smoothly when you get on stage. So getting on stage over and over again, it gets you to a place where you understand what the adrenaline does to you and you understand what your limitations are there. And then you can start careening back toward your flawed human self. But if you think that you're going to just get on stage the first time and be able to express that stuff and let people feel safe enough with you to accept you and enjoy you, then you're insane.
Well, the most fun I ever have on stage, and now it's been the last quite a few years now, I've done certain things so many times that I'm so comfortable with the technical portions of what I'm doing, yeah, is that I'm able to actually talk to the audience and just hang out with them and respond to whatever's going on. That's the most fun I have on stage.
Right. Totally.
Do you have something you want to plug here?
Booby Trap has a podcast. We do half hour.
Oh, that's right. I listened to two of them. I listened to Chris Ruggio and Michael Rainers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Scott has a terrific podcast. It dives deep into what is going on with us variety artists.
Yeah, so most of them are half-hour conversations, just digging into trying to say, get to that same thing. Like, what's your passion? Why are you doing this? And give a little bit of meat to the acts that people have seen at Booby Trap. Even if you haven't seen Booby Trap, you can listen to the podcast. And Scott Neri's Booby Trap's podcast, hosted by Scott Neri. And it is on the podcast places.
And where can they get tickets to Booby Trap if they're in LA?
They can get them online if they search for Booby Trap Show, or they go to boobyla.com.
Booby LA?
Yeah.
Is that what you call your committee, the boobies?
The boobies. We were thinking about calling the volunteers bras because they support us. But
oh!
And it's California. So
and then you can create a package where they send a certain amount of money for a donation. They receive a bra because they're supporting the cause.
Yeah.
Yeah. There you go. Well, I'll let you go, Scott. You've been awesome.
Yeah. Thank you so much, John.
Well, thank you. I appreciate everything you're doing with Booby Trap and kind of raising the bar for variety artists. I appreciate all of that. And I appreciate you, my friend.
That's all for this episode of The Variety Artist. But your journey continues on our website. Go to thevarietyartist.com for more strategies, insight, and resources, as well as show notes on today's guest to assist you in your career. We'll see you on the next episode of The Variety Artist. But until then, go out and book those gigs, make some money, and have some fun.